Welcome to Volume 1 in the series, South Pender Pioneer Families, with Barb and John Pender. This series is dedicated to learning about the unique and important history of South Pender Pioneer Families and their connection to Stais, South Pender Island, and the surrounding Salish Sea. Barb and John, two descendants of the original Pender settler family, will speak in depth of their family connection to Pender. Barb will open with a chronological description of the family history on Pender. They will both share stories of visits to South Pender when they were children during the 50s and 60s. They will both provide insight as to what life was like for their grandparents, Lilias and Arthur Spalding. They will talk about why Pender Island was so special to them as children and why it was important for both of them to make Pender Island their home. That and so much more. This recording was made in January 2024 at Barb's home on South Pender Island and is made possible with grants administered by the South Pender Historical Society. I am your host, Chris Walkluck, and it is my pleasure to present this series to you. My voice has been extracted from this final audio in order to give maximum time and clarity to the interviewees to communicate and share their stories. Thank you for listening. Now here is Barb and John sharing the Pender family story.
My name's Barb Pender, and I was going to tell the story of how the Pender family came to South Pender Island. The island is named after Lieutenant Daniel Pender, who surveyed the West Coast from 1857 to 1870. Daniel Pender likely never set foot on Pender Island, but as was the custom in those days, the island needed a name, just as Saturna and Main Island were given their names from the surveyors of that time. It has been a long journey in documenting if we were ever related to Daniel Pender in some way, and it wasn't until a few years ago that my cousin Charles Pender in London made proof through Ancestry.com that our generation, Charles, John, and myself, are in fact three cousins four times removed. It wasn't until 1912 that William Eustick Pender of Budogveen, Cornwall, came to the west coast of British Columbia, and while touring the Gulf Islands was caught in a storm and had to take shelter in Bedwell Bay. In search of accommodations, he was guided to the Spalding farm up in the valley. Arthur and Lilias Spalding took him in, and he must have made a big stir, subsequently catching the eye of Elizabeth Betty Spalding, one of Arthur and Lilias's children. Beatrice, Bee or Beaky as she was called, Helen and Herbert were Arthur and Lilias's other children. William married Betty March 9, 1914, and soon headed back to England, where William became a major in the First World War. Arthur Benjamin Eustick Pender, my father, was born January 25, 1915, in Falmouth, England, but came back to South Pender Island around 1918 to live and grow up with his grandparents, Arthur and Lilias. William and Betty were to have two more children, Anne and Evelyn Jiggs, they called her. They moved around quite a bit in the other islands, but moved back to South Pender a couple times for long durations, finally settling for some time in a small cabin where Patrick Smith now lives at the end of the valley. Connections with other families grew. Bee got married to Bruce Irving, who had two children, Hope, who married Jeff Jennings, thus the Jennings connection, and Kelly Wyman, his real name, Irving, had Ruth, Robin, and Kelly Jr. Kelly and Sue live on North Pender, as it now. Thus, the Irving connection. Herbert and Winifred Spalding had two sons, Jonathan and David. David had five children, Elizabeth, Pamela, Jane, Michael, and Jonathan. John and Donna reside on South Pender on the same road as I live on here. And Anne Pender married Leonard Henshaw, having one son, Daniel, thus making the Henshaw connection. Although only connected by marriage here, we all went to the same gatherings every year and attended many reunions, mainly down at the Blue House, now the Christie residence, Jiggs and Derek's home, and now summer home for Richard and wife Cindy. As far as how I came to be on Pender Island, I was born actually in North Vancouver to my father, Arthur, and his wife, Connie. Then we moved actually when I was about 3 to Ucluelet on the West Coast and lived there for about 3 years and then moved to Chemainus. And then I graduated and have been coming here. But we always came here with mom and dad for holidays when I was young. We never went anywhere else, really. We always came here and always had a place to stay. So that's my connection to Pender.
It would be summertime. It was always summertime. We never really came here. When we got a little bit older, maybe when we were living in Chemainus, we would come occasionally for Easter or something. But it was always, and the places we stayed in would be rundown shacks that had no light or power or anything. When I came here for the first time, that I can remember in the late 50s and that, there was no power at all. We did not get power on South Pender until in the early 60s. So there was a place called in the valley, the old, the Aunt's Place or whatever, which is now became Ann and Len's Place. And we stayed there a couple of times. So most of the time it was down Gallen Point. And there was an old white house that was right at the end of Gallen Point, but it was deserted. There was no furniture. It was just this house with a roof over it. And I think I don't even know if there was a stove in there at that point, but we'd go in the summertime. It didn't matter. It was just a roof over for the occasional time it rained or whatever. And then we'd stay in Kelly's little log cabin, which was down by the beach, or we'd stay in what Ann and Len were living in, and now with just the Christie place. There was a big house there at that point, and we'd stay there a few times. It all depended what time of the year, when we came, and who, maybe somebody else was staying there. So we would just go in and make the most of it. Up in the farm up by, in Johnny's Field, out the back, there was this house that it was built, I think, in 1930. And by the time we stayed in it, it leaned kind of. And the floorboards were going up and down and everything else, but it had a wood stove and it still worked. And there was some bedrooms, and Jeff Jennings owned that property. Johnny's Field was an area of property just right by their barn, up away from the ocean. They have this farm in there that runs up the valley. Most people don't see it. It's still there. But when Dad bought his property, it was almost adjacent to Johnny's Field, whatever kind of area. If you came along Gallen Point Road, just by Higgs Road, if you went across, you'll see a sign, no trespassing. Anyway, back in that area. It'd only be a few weeks, usually. It was kind of thing, and it depended, too, on like different holidays, whether the Henshaw kids would be there at the same time. Sometimes they were, sometimes they weren't. And if they were, then we'd get together for baseball games up in Johnny's Field, play baseball with whatever we had. Nobody probably had any gloves or anything. We'd just get up there, smack the ball, and run. There was always parties. There was always a gathering, a big fete, they called, down near just off Higgs Road, where I know Dr. Sutherland lived there now, and I'm not sure who lives there now, but there would be a big party for the whole island would come, and there would be the horses, Cheyenne and Pico, that lived down on the point, and the kids could go and ride on Cheyenne. One summer there, I was in charge of that, making sure getting all the smaller kids on the horses and leading them out around the point and that. I couldn't let them go because they had a habit of taking off. So if you got little kids on there, you got to make sure you hold on to the horses and lead them. But they were interesting. The Cheyenne and Pico were there for many years, lived right on Gallen Point, and you could go and ride them, and they were good. We didn't have any saddles or anything. You just held onto the mane, head up towards the main road. But then once you got up to the main road by Clochy Road and what's now Gallen Point and started heading them back down towards John Smith's, where they were, they would take off. You had no real control over them because they would just go complacently along when you were going away from the paddock. But once you turned them and started heading back, they were ready to go home, and they would just take off. So you were ready, and you were holding. It was like riding a Bronco, and you'd be getting, and you'd be heading down the trails and heading down. Okay, and they're heading. And then at one point, you start looking for the best place to fall off because you know it's coming, and you're looking, okay, I can't hold off, and bang, and you find a softer spot to fall off, and then they would take off and head back to the paddock, and then somebody else would get on them and start the routine all over again.
Remember Cheyenne used to, I was up on the Green Hill or whatever, there was some stumps up there, and he'd just take it upon himself to run full force to the stump and then turn this way so I go flying into the stump. I had bruises and everything. I'll never forget it. Yeah.
Was sort of go out and play, you know, and we would do scary things. I remember when I was like 5 years old, myself and another kid, we disappeared. We decided we were going to walk all the way down to Bedwell Harbor, but not take the road. We wanted to go along the cliffs, all the edge, the shoreline, as tight to the shoreline as we could, which meant climbing along and going down and looking over. If you ever go there and you see there is some major cliffs. And so I was 5, I think he was 6, and we took off. And I can still remember going along these edges, and there was trees and there was arbutus leaves, and it was sort of slippery and sliding, and thinking, oh, we could just slide over the edge of this cliff. But we were gone, and we were having fun. This is an adventure. Little did we know that the rest of the island was out looking for us. There was a big picnic happening down at the beach, and everybody had gathered. And all of a sudden, John and Stephen, I think, was the other boy's name. Anyway, we were gone, and they were searching. At one point, we saw somebody coming along the road, and they had a horse. And they were just leading the horse, and they were talking. And they said, well, have you seen them? No, I haven't seen them. Well, let's go out. We'll go down to Bedwell and see if anything's down there, whatever kind of thing. Boy, I don't know where they are. And we're hiding in the bushes and listening and thinking, who are they talking about? And then it came to us that maybe we should head back. So we finally did return down to Gowland Point. And we came down and suddenly looking, there was all sorts of people down there gathered on the road. And here's my dad, and he's looking up the road and he sees me. He comes running up the road. And I'm thinking, this don't look like he's really happy to see me. Like I say, I was only 5 years old, but I can remember it. It was very, it's something really stuck in my mind, especially when he was running up to me and he went over to the side of the road and broke off a little stick off of a tree. And I said, oh, no, this ain't going to be good. And so it was, there you are. Where have you been? And so grab him and it's off. And then slap, bang, bang, you know, corporal punishment was a popular part of life back then. And so everybody was happy to see us in their own way. And that was the last time, I think, that we decided to take off like that by ourselves.
I think what is one of my favorite memories is as soon as we arrived anywhere, whatever cabin we were in or whatever, was I wanted to get off down to see B. Freeman, her name, last name was at that time. That was my grandma's sister, Bee. And she just had such wonderful stories. She had a really comfy, cozy living room. And she had so many pictures. And she'd always have a glass of lime cordial waiting there for us when we came. And
a huge bowl of agates.
Agates, yeah.
She gathered every agate off the beach. Agates, I don't know if you're familiar with what they are, but they're a clear stone that you can see light through and everything. And she had enormous ones. I mean, like, there was some, like, you know, size bigger than a golf ball kind of thing. And it was we always searched down on the beach for agates because Aunt Bee always found them. She'd just sit there on the beach and, you know, she was sitting there. She'd be always turning over the rocks on the beach, just turning them over and looking and thing. And she would find them. But we found maybe occasional little ones or whatever. But she had enormous.
It was, she always had that
cigarette.
It was sort of flattened on the side of her.
Just
her
hanging
thing.
There.
And
she never had
a rolly, and she would always have it in her mouth, and she could talk.
Just
and she talking could do everything.
And a cigarette hanging out of the side of her mouth. You know, just. You know, talking away, and it was like you'd be thrilled. You'd be steer. It's gonna fall. I think it's gonna fall. No. Yeah, but she was quite the character, and she was a woman's libber way before woman's lib took over. She dressed, I don't think I ever saw her in a dress. She was always wearing pants. She was her own person. And she was a great chronicler of the island and things. And she put together the Gulf Islands patchwork that is still out today. There's volumes 1 and 2. And she put a lot of work into that, getting stories from Gulf Islanders all over, from Maine, Galliano, Saturna, Pender, North Pender, and South. And it's an excellent book if you haven't read it and you want to know something about the history of the Gulf Islands, then you should be reading the Gulf Islands patchwork. Because of her love for the islands and feeling that somebody had to preserve those stories about how things started, how Miners Bay got its name or whatever, or how whatever happened here on that murder point on Saturna, or just making sure that these stories were not forgotten, and while these people were still alive, all these historical figures from all the islands wrote in that book, all the people who were the early settlers who came here around the turn of the century and lived through and created what we have now on the islands here, that is unfortunately a lot different. It's definitely not what it was. And I think that's why she wanted to do it too, because she knew that times were changing and that it was important that it was not forgotten how much work these people did to make these islands, you know, and how now, yeah, I sort of think that things are forgotten. I mean, people, we're just, I'm sorry, but I don't think we have the real history here on the island that we used to. It's sort of become just another place to live for a lot of people. It's, you know, a lot of people come here now and they don't really connect. And so they come for a while thinking, oh, this will be good. I can live here and I'll become an islander. But they come here and they get bored. They don't get connected. They don't get involved with community. And that, I think, is the key for what it was back then. It was community. Everybody was, they knew everybody. There weren't that many people. And now it's got more people, but I don't think we know as many people as they did back then. They knew everybody on the islands. But now you have your little groups and that. I mean, there are people who really get involved in the island and who work hard in that. But I think the idea of volunteerism is the most important way to get involved in your community, whether it's Pender Island or Spuzzum or wherever. When people came here and started a new life, they would usually be welcome with open arms, you know, and it would become, they'd purchase some property, whether they purchase something, grandfather sold great parcels of his land off as the years went by. He not only had his 300 acres on South Pender, which was his base, but he also had property from Medicine Beach down to Thieves Bay, all through that area. And he sold most of that off at different intervals just so that he could maintain his lifestyle of the English gentleman on South Pender Island. I try in my own little way to try and keep that alive. And I've gotten involved with the museum now. And I've been down there and a few times now just to tell stories and talk to people down at the museum. Over Christmas, I went down, I wrote a story about Christmas 100 years ago. And also retold a story about the boys who went off to war from South Pender Island. And I think that's important. And there is people who are really interested in that, who really want to know the history, who come here and want to become part of that historical avenue that is Pender Island. I mean, they just want to know. And I don't know, it makes them feel comfortable. Other people come here and then they leave. You can tell right away if somebody's going to hang in here and become an islander. And it takes a while. And I think we're fairly welcoming, aren't we?
Yeah. I think obviously when I was younger, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it immensely coming in on the beaches. Just we were down the beach all day, every year. Every time we came, Dad would build us a raft and we'd be out rafting, hooking up to the kelp and waiting for the big waves to come in, and rowing. We rowed so much around the islands, and Dad always had a rowboat, and we were out, and there, you know, the whales would go by. It was all a wonderful experience. But once I started getting into my teens, it wasn't as much. It was like really dragged to have to come to Pender, I thought, because, you know, I'd love to go see B and everything like that. But other than that, I was like, you know, the usual teenage bored, you know, like, this is boring. I want to go to Kelowna, or I want to go somewhere else where we always came to Pender. So, you know, you gradually drift away from it. But then Mom and Dad moved here in 1976 and built the house down on Gowan Point Road. So it was much more permanent. So I was always coming over then. And then I got married and then had kids and stuff. So then eventually I came over and I house sat for them one summer while they went to Europe. They finally got a chance to go off to Europe. So I was here for about 4 months and I worked down at Bedwell, which is sort of the usual thing to do when you come over here. And so I got a bit of a taste of kind of living here a little bit more. And went off again, and then living my life mainly on the lower mainland, Vancouver Island and everything. And then I ended up moving here in about 1987, I think it was. And so I lived here, and my kids went to school here and did their early days of school here in the little thing. There was only about 100. Less than 100 kids in the school at that time. And then I moved away again in 91 back to Nanaimo, and I was gone for 9 years. But all that time, just that little taste that I had in there of living here and the wonderful community, that I just wanted to come back. I just, you know, I lived in Qualicum and I lived in different places, but I just always wanted to come back to Pender. My heart was here, so I moved back. And been here since 2002. And I said, when I go back this time, I'm going to rot here. I don't want to ever go away again. This is my home. I think the last part there where I was the worst, because I was living in Vancouver, and sounds really romantic and everything, living on a sailboat down in the Inner Harbor and doing all that. And then we sold the boat and went to live in an apartment in Kits. And I don't know, I just felt like, oh my God, it's so hard to get to know people. And, you know, like, they're all, you know, we used to have potlucks on the docks and different places, and it felt like a bit more of a community. And then it was just like, oh my gosh, I've got to get away from here. I just got to get back to Pender, where, you know, there's always something to do. You actually have to sort of hold back a little bit and kind of say, I'm not going to volunteer for this or that. But it was that sense of community where, you know, it was okay to be by yourself, but that you know that there was always something there you can get involved in, and the people are so wonderful. Yeah.
As I mentioned just a few minutes ago, that Bea, she was an independent spirit, and she could be very lovable, and she could be very cantankerous. And you took her as she came, and she had her moments, as everybody does. But, you know, when you think back, and I thought about people in my life who, you know, who stood out. And I think Bea is probably right at the top of the list of people who were just special people who didn't sit back. Her life, she went through 3 husbands, I think. She was trying as far as on husbands. I mean, because she was so free-spirited in that. And she was Pender Island. When we came here, it was always Bea. That was the central place where we would go and play Chinese checkers when it rained or whatever. And as Barb says, the roses lime cordial, which always, every time I see the bottle, I think of Bea, and the cookies and things, and just... over at Hope and Jeff's across the way, and then going swimming in the old dirty pond up by Johnny's Field. That was this pond. Those water came down from Greenburn Lake. Jeff had a pipe, and it filled this murky, and it was like just like an enormous puddle. And we had a boat that sank. It had a big hole in the bottom. It would float for maybe 2 minutes, and then it would sink again. So you'd drag it out, and you'd tip it over, and then everybody would pile into it and get out there and out in the middle, and then it would sink, and everybody, Titanic, we're going down. But it's just memories that live in your mind. And again, it was most of these memories are just from a few weeks every summer for us. As I say, there was times when we would come other times of the year, but it was the summer times and just going fishing and going out with grown-ups and going out with John Freeman, Bee's husband at the time. And I remember going out with him and catching fish. He had an old inboard boat that we'd putter along, whatever, but it was one of the few boats that on the island kind of thing and that. But I remember going out just me and him one time and catching a salmon and thinking how great this was and having this experience. And that was another thing, catching fish, going out and getting ling cod that were as big as this table in front of me here. I mean, 40 pounds with heads as big as a basketball, and catching tommy cod, which were, you know, fight like a sea trout. They were just going in down into the kelp, and you'd fight them and bring them up, and then, or jig for bass, or just regular rock cod, or scalpins, and snappers. I mean, the fish, they were everywhere. If you wanted fish, you went out and says, okay, we need some fish. So you go down to the point, and you put a line down, and boom, 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 you bring it up, and you got it. But I think in the 70s and 80s, there was too much commercial fishing. People were coming and getting all their fish. They're just keeping everything for their live traps. They would take and keep them alive in restaurants in Vancouver, and so that they could just like, okay, this fish is going to grow up a little more, and then you can eat him. And suddenly, and then there was an oil spill one year that really kind of killed off all the sea life. There was no oysters and the clams and the sea urchins, and everything died there for, well, close to 20 years, I think. This was probably in the early 80s, and there was like nothing until close to the 2000s, really, down there. It was like you could see for years, you'd walk and there would be this film on the rocks down there. Gallon Point, all that area down through there. And we used to get clams all down there, but for a long time, we couldn't get them. And the sea urchins, there used to be all just all along by the rocks, all everywhere, sea urchins with all their big spikes and kind of thing. You could go and you could, at low tide, you could go down and just grab them. They were all taken by the fishermen and whatever, and that during that oil spill, which I don't think was ever reported kind of thing. There was never a big thing about it, but it was the locals who, you know, suddenly there's all this film over everything. Eventually, it has come back. It has. It didn't kill it off entirely, but it put a bit of a swath into the harvest of sea fish, like the crustaceans down there that really were hit hard. Mom was a war bride. Dad went off to war in 1939, didn't come home until 45, 6 years out of his life, the prime years of his life, where he could have been establishing himself in a business and having a career or whatever, but he didn't. He went off, and it was the best thing that ever happened to him in the long run, because he met Connie, this young English girl, and they married in 1944. And at the end of the war, near the end of the war, they started repatriating all the war brides. And so Mom was sent out here to Canada before Dad was decom. So she came to Pender Island in 1945, not knowing anything about. She came out with all these other war brides across Canada, and the train dropping girls out into snow-swept areas of the prairies that were just like hell. And mom's going, oh, please, please don't make me get out at something like this. And then they went through the Rockies and she came into Vancouver and there was a city. There was some friends we had there and she stayed there in West Vancouver with the Parkins. And then they put her on the Princess Mary, I think it was, or whatever, one of the many ships, or the Otter or whoever it was at the time that was running back and forth. And she sailed into Bedwell Harbor in the spring of 1945. And there was Granny, Lilia Spaulding, and a couple of the great aunts. And they all came down and they met her and took her up to the Spaulding place. And that's where she went until Dad was decommissioned about 5 or 6 months later or whatever. But she was here on this island all by herself, just coming from London. And now she's here at this place. There's no power. There's nothing. It's just, and she knows no one. it was definitely a culture shock. But she grew to love her in-laws. And then when Dad came out shortly afterwards, they managed to again have a bit of a honeymoon there on Pender. And then they went off to Duncan, where Dad bought some property. He had money that was given to him when he was, because a lot of years he was over there and he didn't, all his money just went into an account. So when they finished, they got a pretty good check. So he managed to put a down payment on property in Duncan near Somonos. And then in 1951, Mom got homesick and they went back to England. And that's when I was born. And so I was actually born in England, but I was conceived in Canada. 6 months later, I was back in Canada. So my time in there was, I only had 6 months of time in Britain, though, but now I have a London birthplace. Anyway, they came back here, and again, it was back to North Vancouver and blah, blah. And so Dad never really got to go back to Pender Island until he retired in 76. Oh, that was another thing I talked about with the war. Dad went over there and he was there and he lost three of his friends from Pender Island who didn't come back. Alan Crane, Phil Teese, and Fred Connery. They all died over there. And there was only five young men on South Pender who went off to war. So the percentages were not good for those young men and how it must have hurt that community to lose the heart and soul of their community, that these boys went off to war and never came back. And I often think about that, and it's part of the reason why I am so heavily involved in the Royal Canadian Legion, is because my dad was, and he always wanted to keep their memory alive. They gave everything, and so the least he could do, and I feel the least I can do, is to make sure that those boys who went over there and made the ultimate sacrifice were never forgotten. Again, like with Barb and I, that we have gotten involved in the island. We've come back here, and we're part of the community. We do things. Both involved with the Historical Society. We're both involved with Solstice Theater and both involved in the Legion. And that involvement is what I think makes an islander. If you find your niche where you can grab on to something and you meet people and you become, you know, that you become part of the island. And that's how you do it nowadays. It was before, back in my father's day. If you came here, you probably came to work for grandfather, and he went through a lot of people that good and bad, and farmhands that would come. They were travelers, and they would come for 6 months or a year or maybe a year and a half. They would go. They were a revolving door of people who would come and work on the farm, just because they needed people. He needed people to do the chores, to do things, to help. And he would supply a small stipend and plus room and board. And for a lot of them, and I know one in particular, Charlie Biggs, He was here in 1929 into 30, right in the involvement of when, if you're familiar with the stock market crash, was right in that time. And he put in about a year he was here, but I met his daughter many years later, and actually Dad never lost his connection with Charlie Biggs. Even though he was only here for that 1 year, Dad visited him several times. He went to visit him during the war and then got back there when he got older. He went and visited him again in the late 70s and into the 1980s. And I became friends with Charlie Biggs's daughter, Helen, and I have been over there and visited her several times. And she actually came out here the year after Dad died. I spent some time with her, showed her all over the island, and she related to me how much that 1 year meant to her father. It was one of the most important parts of his life that he talked about forever in his life, that how, and he even, Charlie Biggs wrote poetry about the Spauldings and the Penders, and I have a poem that he wrote that when he saying goodbye to Pender Island. And I read that one time at the Historical Society meeting down on South Pender. And but it just shows that all these people came. And if you look at David Spaulding's book, Put That Damn Matic Away, he talks about all these people who came, and some were good and some were bad. And, you know, and how, and in that book, that when Charlie left, grandfather was a damn fine fellow. Didn't go on a lot, but he said, one of the finest workers I've had. And as I say, that these people that came here, it became a very important thing for them too. They thought the Spauldings were the greatest, that grandfather was the, you know, this wonderful guy. There was some who didn't, and grandfather got rid of them real quick. The pigs and the going out there and feeding them, or gathering up sheep, or cutting fence posts and digging holes, whatever it took. You know, it was a farm. It was a farm deal. You had to go out there and make sure that, okay, we've got a hole in the fence down at the near Camp Bay. We're going to have to get down there. Charlie, can you go down?
And burning stumps. Wasn't that a big thing that David talked about in his book?
Well,
the valley is a valley now, but it wasn't always. There was trees and everything, and they haven't grown back. Like, they burnt those stumps to the... right down, so that they were never going to come back again.
Oxen. And by hand, and they cleared that whole valley down there. And it's, you know, there's, every time you go down there, I still sort of look, and I it feels that real connection when I drive through that valley, that this was my family. They did this, you know, and that's the why, I guess, why Barb and I are still here, and we probably are going to be here until they pack us up and send us either up or down. Well, he was a man who, he came here, he was not the number one son. That's why he ended up out here, because his family had land in near Rye, Hastings area in southern England. And so it was sort of like, okay, Arthur, your older brother is getting the farm, you're getting the shaft. So head out to the colonies. So he came out to California, didn't really happen there. He headed up the coast, came up to British Columbia, and went to Victoria, which wasn't much there, and back in the mid-1880s. But there was a government there, and they were establishing land leases, and you could, if you went to one of the islands or other sort of more desolate areas, and if you could get a parcel of land for about $1 an acre, and as long as you made improvement to that land, it became yours. And that's what he did. He came to South Pender Island, or Pender Island, because he got a lot of land on South and North Pender. And he worked and cleared, and put in his 6 days a week. But on the Sunday, they always relaxed. They would go and play cricket or tennis or go over croquet. You know, it was there was things that they did. It was and he was a sort of a he brought a bit of England with him. And also Lilius brought some too, because she came from a fairly well-to-do family in Victoria, that the Mackay family. Joe Mackay, her father, was a member of the first BC Legislative Assembly, and he was actually Métis. And so we actually have Métis blood. It shows up more so in certain portions of our family, more so the Irving family, because the Irvings also had more First Nations blood that came into it, or through marriage kind of thing. But Joe Mackay, again, was another incredible fellow who was one of probably the Métis who probably did more in British Columbia or in Canada than just about any other guy. Louis Riel is the person you think of, but Louis was hung, so he didn't get a lot of credit for things he did. But Joe started out at 14 on the West Coast, came out with Douglas, James Douglas, and by the time he was 17, was in charge of trips to the Sandwich Islands, which are now the Hawaiian Islands, and also then became the factor for Fort Nanaimo, who's in charge of the construction of Fort Nanaimo, and built the bastion that's in Nanaimo now, if you go and see that. And as I say, and then at one point he became a member of the first BC Legislative Assembly, along with Blanchard and all the other Dunsmuir and all these other guys who were. There's a picture actually of all of them in their introduction. They're all this fine English gentry, except Joe has a native shawl he's wearing and looking every inch the Métis that he was. For him to rise to that level in those days was unheard of. Anybody with native blood, Métis or whatever, the highest they could think to climb would be as a clerk, as a chief clerk in one of the Hudson's Bay companies. But he went past that, but he was held back because of who he was. He achieved a lot, but he did not get the acclaim that Dunsmuir and Blanchard and all these others, Douglas and everybody else, got because, I think, of his First Nations affiliation. And that was always, okay, you can come here, you can come in here, but there's still a line that you cannot cross. And it's sort of like, and you don't see any Mackay streets in Victoria. All the other ones, everybody else, you know, everybody has got something named after him and has become synonymous with Victoria, but nobody's heard of Joe Mackay. And he did not spend a lot of time on Pender Island. He came here a few times and that, but he died in 1900. But he left a mark. He was in charge of he was the Indian agent, which was what it was called then, and he inoculated 1,000 or so First Nations people for smallpox himself, you know. So, he again was an important part of our family history. Yeah. Yes, he had the most incredible library. And Arthur Spalding's combination of what Lilius brought from her family and what he brought from England, that was my dad's education. He went to school. He went to the one-room school on South Pender, and he went to a little school on Saturna and on Main Island kind of thing, got a little education there. They lived on several. They moved around because my grandfather was off traveling all the time, and so they were like left to make out on their own. So it was kind of they lived over in Colwood area for a while, but my dad's education, he always said, was he learned more from his grandmother, Lilius, than he did from anything else in life. It was because she had a piano and they would sit there and they would play the piano. She would play the piano and at the gatherings, and but time in the library, and there was always books. He was always reading. Dad, it was like Kipling and Robert Service, Jack London, every book that was, you know, important to that time, they had. And he passed that on to me. That was when I was growing up, and there'd be nights on Pender Island late at night where he would pull out Rudyard Kipling and get me to read different excerpts. And I think that became that, you know, I was reading. I was always reading. Dad was making me read. And, well, he wasn't making it, but he was just saying, why don't you read? And I did. And I found that I could read. I could read out loud, and I could, you know, and I enjoyed it. And the stories of Jack London and Robert Service, just all these different people, Charles Dickens. My goodness. I mean, it was that was their life. That's what got them through the winters. There was no TV or computers or, you know, they, at one point, I think somebody had a radio that they could get, maybe in the 30s, they could get Fibber McGee and Molly or whatever, some kind of thing. And they'd sit around and do that. But there would be gatherings at the hall at Hope Bay and dances, and just go to somebody else's house for dinner. And people, there weren't a lot of people, but everybody was a family. Gerald Richardson, my dad's godfather and Arthur Spalding's best friend, was, again, he was a very important part of my dad's life. And that my dad was with him when he died. They were out splitting wood just above where the fire hall is on South Pender, just up the hill there. They were in there cutting wood, and Gerald had a heart attack. And Dad had to run all the way home, back up over the goat trail down into the valley to get Grandfather and to bring him back. And then they brought him down to his place. They took him into the Spalding place to look after him. But he passed within a day or so. And he was only 54, I think. Yeah, because he is buried. Arthur Richardson is buried with Lilias and Arthur Spalding over at the cemetery on Main Island. It's a beautiful plot overlooking Active Pass, just up above Miners Bay. And he was an important part of there. That area, all in there, where with Bedwell Harbor and where the fire hall and all that area in there was his property, going up to the lake. Kerosene lanterns, candles, you know, that was it, you know. And it was, I think that's why in later life, Dad's eyesight wasn't that good. I'm sure he peered over a lot of books and that. But, you know, it'd get to a point that they weren't staying up late. You know, it would be early to bed and early to rise. And there'd be, that's right, Guinness. And so there'd be chores to be done. You know, there would be, you know, you had things to do. You know, it was your life. It wasn't anything artificial in your life. This is my dog who wants to talk now, too, if you can hear her on there. When we went there in the summertime, it was light until late, you know, but once it got dark, pretty much we were off to bed. And we'd get up because it would get light at 6 in the morning. And or 5 or 6 or whatever. So you'd be up early and you'd go do things. I remember reading just about every Agatha Christie book when I was a kid that they had down at Aunt Anne's. She had them all, whatever. So just go grab another one and read, you know. And that was in the 60s. And different adventures. I remember staying. I stayed on in 1963. Everybody else went home, but I stayed with Aunt Bee. And I stayed for one day because then I went off with the Martins, who lived across from Poets Cove area there in Glen Warple. If you go down to Poets Cove and look across, it's still there. And the big sign, Glen Warple, is still on the beach. And there was this log cabin still there. Doesn't look as quite as big as it did then when I was a kid. And I remember I spent a week there with Donnie Martin and his family, And we explored all those areas in 1963. And we went over into Beaumont's park before it was a park. The old Dr. Beaumont's house, the remains of it were still there. And then we went and we explored all around out on what's now Trincomalee. We explored that whole area and caught crabs with oars in our boat. He had a little 10-foot runabout with a 5-horse on it. And we'd scoot around everywhere and we'd get these crabs off the beach with an oar. And they were everywhere. You could just scoop them up and throw them in the boat. And then we'd take them over to Bedwell Harbor, long before Poets Cove, and we'd sell them to the tourists there for 25 cents apiece. We did that. And then I remember, then I had to go home. And it was, I remember B took me to the ferry after this, all these adventures we did there, spent a great, oh, we had the pancake. I forgot the pancake eating contest. That was, I remember eating 16 pancakes. Donnie Martin ate 15, and I managed, I was chucked. Oh, I got down that 16th. And I don't even think it was a prize. It was just, and it was Mrs. Martin and Bonnie, and there was another daughter, I can't remember her name, but they watched us, and I remember, oh gosh, was I full. I mean, it was just, but I won, and it's, the memory stuck with me. The stomach ache, yeah, that stuck with me too. But we, Aunt B took me to the ferry, put me on the ferry, and then I got off at Swartz Bay. Dad came down from Chemainus, where we were living, and picked me up from there. And get in there, and Dad says, "Well, so how was your holiday? I mean, how's Aunt B? Oh, Aunt B's okay. She's good. It says I didn't spend much time there. Well, why not? Well, Dad, I went and I explored, and I did things I think that are gonna live with me the rest of my life, and." There are so many things like that, that I look back and there's moments that have stuck with me. So many other things in my life, they're gone, you know, from 20, 30, 40 years ago. But that time, even then I knew that this was a memory that was going to stick with me. And it was Pender Island, while it was still just a wild Pender Island. It was like there was nobody there. We could explore and do things and go and walk wherever we wanted. And there's lots of places to walk on this island, but it's, you know, can't just walk across everybody's property now. Sometimes I do and I get in trouble, but still, it's that time I think is gone, but I'm glad that at least I have a memory of when, you know, there was a time on this island that you could just, it was your island. It was my island.
I totally think about the summers of spending a lot of time on the beach, just down at the end, you know, the end of Gallon. We used to call it the lizard that goes out, but we're just down at the end. And in the corner, there's a little pond that the water always leaves, a little pond, and just in there catching bullheads for hours on end. Like you do things like that. You just spend, or you go and you grab the kelp and turn it into a beauty salon and cut their hair, and you just become really creative on the beach just for hours and hours and hours. I think we would spend never ending time down there making things, and the rafts were just so much fun. You know, I remember taking grandma, mom's mom, Gladys came out from England, and I took her out on the raft. You know, had it paddle and everything, and we hooked up to the kelp beds out there, and that's when a big freighter had gone by, and all of a sudden there was a whole bunch of people on the beach, and I could hear them all screaming and everything as we were going out of sight over these huge waves coming. And there's grandma, who's about 70 something or other, sitting on that raft. I'll never forget it as long as I live. She was laughing. She could. You know, and it was just so funny. You could hear and everything.
I think she'd never experienced coming. She grew up, her whole life was in London, just outside of London. And to be here out in the colonies at her age, and she was in her 70s and old like me. And She, I can just see her still laughing, just going, "Oh, I never would have thought this could happen to me." You know, but she got to experience Pender Island.
Yeah,
she passed away on Pender Island.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I want to tell you about Cadborosaurus. Cadborosaurus was this sea serpent that was reported all along this area, down through around Victoria, or Cadborough Bay. It was sighted several times, where the name came from. But it was also spotted many times around Pender Island by just about every member of the island. They all saw this thing, and Dad himself was out in a boat one time, and it came along and sailed by and grabbed a seagull, reached up and just grabbed a seagull out of the air and pulled it down under into the ocean. And this thing, it was seen by so many people. It was in the Times Colonist. If you go back in the archives, you'll see that in the mid, I think it was 1936, around 35, 36, that it was reported for weeks and weeks. There was another story in the Times Colonist about Cadborosaurus, about another person seeing this thing and whatever. And there was a fellow from Main Island wrote this book about it. And actually, Dad's picture is in that book, not saying that he is Cadborosaurus, but as one of the people who witnessed this. And they tell his recollections of that. And he never really talked about it a lot, because everybody would sort of, yeah, right, Art. Yeah, okay. You know, but it had almost like the head of a camel with a long snout kind of thing. A head, it was like a snake, but it came out of the water. There was actually what they thought was a juvenile one that was caught up in the Haida Gwaii, Queen Charlotte's area. And there's actually a picture of it. It's not a great picture. It's like, you know, you always see a picture of the Sasquatch or whatever, and it's fuzzy or whatever. But this was a picture of this long sort of snake-like thing on top of a dock. And anyway, this was taken down to Washington State Biological place or whatever, and it, like... all the other flying saucer people in that, has disappeared. It disappeared. You're not allowed to show these or whatever kind of thing. So, but it's something that, you know, everybody looks at it and thinks, oh yeah, whatever. But I think there was something. I believe there was, because so many people saw this thing. And whether it's still there, I don't think so. Probably not. It was there in the 30s. And I've talked to people, other people, that said they saw it in the 50s or whatever. But it lived in the ocean. It was a sea serpent, as close as you can come. And there has been more documentation about Cadborosaurus than probably any other so-called sea serpent. Way more than Ogopogo or Loch Ness, All these other ones. They're all so much vaguer. But this one has so many first-hand affidavits saying that they saw this thing, and
it came right out of the ocean and had this sort of scaly head with a snout, and I don't know, some said it had ears and other ones said it didn't have ears. I don't know, but I mean, like, it was just in the description of it, it could have been just the way the sun was shining on it or something like that, but it was huge. Yeah, but just in continuation of Mum, I do remember really, really well that Mum did go back to England because, you know, she was an only child and you know, she missed her home. I mean, she was in the Blitz before she came out here. And I mean, that was all she knew. But when she went back, all it did was confirm with her how much she loved it here. This was, you know, it just... by going back made her realize how much she loved Canada and the Gulf Islands. Yeah, I remember her saying to me that very many, many times she did. And then I wanted John to tell the story of the big fish that got away in the boat. It makes me laugh every time. Sorry.
Okay, that's going back to the catching giant lingcods. one day my dad and I were out fishing off of Gowland Point, and what we did usually, we'd just go out and we'd tie up to the kelp bed, and we'd drop the line over, and dad had a 14-foot aluminum, and we'd just sitting there whiling away, and suddenly, well, we caught some, we caught a little bit here and there, and then suddenly I got, boom, and I got, holy moly, I've got this thing on there, and it's big, and I'm pulling, whoa, and I'm line pulling this thing in, and I'm going, whoa, this is heavy, Dad, come on. And so Dad's got, he's getting ready, he's got his gaff, and we didn't, it was no net, he didn't have the net, he says, we're gaffing this baby, and so get it up there, and we look, and I go, whoa, look at the size of this ling, and it was like I said, it had like a basketball, bigger than a basketball, and it was like, and it comes to the edge of the boat. And also, oh, I forgot a little aside. There was another boat had pulled up alongside while we were fishing there. And I think they saw that I was funny. So they slowed down. And there's this guy over there, and he's got his little girl in the boat. And she must have been like 4 or 5 years old. And, you know, and he's right, just almost right there watching. He says, okay, Betty, just watch this. This is how you catch fish, you know. And he says, okay. So I'm pulling this thing in, and this, you know, and I get whoa, and they got this enormous, the dad reaches over, and he comes in, and he puts his gaff in there, pulls it up, whoa, and he pulls it into the boat, and it's as wide as the boat, and it's flopping around, and meanwhile, and while it's there, it comes off the hook, and what we have is another small ling cod on the hook that's already there, but now the big one is it's just going, and meanwhile, and Dad's trying to stop it and get the banger to put this thing out, and he's but and then he falls over, and he, now all of a sudden, bam, and what he and his oh his leg's bleeding, and I'm trying to and it's off, and it's going over here, and it's banging, and I sort of look out of the corner of my eye, and here's this little girl, and they're and watching us, and they got this like a 45-50 pound ling cod in the boat. And it's going like this, and it's somehow got its basketball size head up over the gunwale, and start and you can't just grab hold of that because they have spikes in the top, or else you know you got to be careful and everything. And I can't. And Dad's laying in the bow, bleeding, and I'm just going, oh, and it's gone. It got its head over the edge and just went, and I couldn't, it was just slipping through, and I couldn't grab, I couldn't hold it, and it was gone. It went, whew, and it's all quiet. And I look at Dad, and Dad looks at me, and we look at the people in the boat, and they're just, oh, holy moly. And it's, and Dad says, well, that was interesting. I says, what? That's the biggest ling cod I ever caught, and I didn't even catch it, and it was gone. And I could, but we just sort of looked at each other and started to laugh and going, okay, well, put the line down. Let's see what else we can get. Well, oh, we still got that little one on the. We still got the little one there. Forgot even about that laying up in there, and it was. Nah, that's too small to keep. We'll put that one back, but. Oh yeah, that was it was an interesting fishing trip.
Thank you very much to Barb and John for doing this interview. This interview and the entire series has been made possible with funding from the Capital Regional District, the Pender Island Community Resource Center, the Wasanich Leadership Council, Wasanich School Board, the Pender Islands Museum, and the South Pender Historical Society. Thank you to all these organizations for contributing to make these recordings possible.